Thank you very much. Please be seated. Thank you very much. You scared me. You stood up. I thought you were leaving. I am delighted to be with you this morning. I am honored that the governor and all of those that had any say in this program today, I'm delighted and honored that you would think enough of me that you extend an invitation for me to come and to be with you this morning on this special occasion. I have had the great privilege over the last 15 or 20 years to be able to travel around the country and throughout the state of Oklahoma during this time of the year to celebrate the life and legacy and memory of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I've got to tell you, this morning it's a little bit more special because I am in Atlanta, Georgia. I am with the pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, who is, I guess, the church that I kind of picked up on the ministry and the life of Dr. King and his ministry. And I am grateful for what Dr. King, what he did and what he stood for, what his life was about. And I think it's important that, first of all, I want to set the record straight. I'm a little bit offended that you all are, as Georgians, taking the ownership for Dr. King, or as though, well, just let me say it. I'm a little bit offended that you all are taking Dr. King and being selfish about him being a Georgian. I claim him as well, being an Oklahoman. I have, the 8 years that I served in Congress, the fact that I played football at the University of Oklahoma, much of that was in large part due to what Dr. King stood for and what he fought for. I am eternally grateful. I'm eternally grateful for that. And I feel it's extremely appropriate at this particular time to give thanks to and to pay a debt of gratitude to Mrs. King and to the kids of Dr. King, to the family of Dr. King, because being married and having children and spending 12 years on the front line in public service as an elected official, and I don't care what party one is in, Democrat, Republican, federal level, state level, county, municipal level, there's a sacrifice that these men and the women pay to spend time in public service. And there is a price that their families pay. A husband or a wife might be the ones with the vote, but the spouse serves as well. Governor Perdue may be the one that is the governor of the state, but Mary serves every day of her life that he is. Seeing Mary sitting here this morning, I'm reminded of what my wife said to me once. She said, someone told her, said, behind every husband is a supportive wife. And she said, no, behind every successful husband is a surprised wife. So Sister King, from the Watts family, Coretta Scott King, we are grateful for what you and your family gave up to allow Dr. King to serve humanity. All those family dinners that he missed and all those times that he could have been in the front yard playing catch with one of his kids or helping with homework, he was on the road or out in the community trying to make a difference so that J.C. Watts could have the right to run for Congress, in spite of my skin color. That J.C. Watts could play football at the University of Oklahoma and be a quarterback, in spite of my skin color. So Coretta Scott King, and to the children of Dr. King, we owe you a serious, serious debt of gratitude. I am no longer a member of Congress. I chose about 3 years ago to get off that political treadmill, and I did want to go home and be a husband again and to be a father again and be able to do some of those things that I had not done in a long time, like doing parent-teacher conferences and going to ball games with my son on Tuesday nights and on Friday nights, and to go to my daughter's dance recitals and do all of those things that I had not done in a long time. And I'm doing those things again. And Governor, about 2.5 years ago, I did something that I had never done before, but everybody around me was on a diet, so I thought I would go on a diet. And it was the worst 3 hours of my life. But it is kind of good to be off that political treadmill, and I don't know, in public service, you might leave public life, but you never leave public service. We all have a responsibility. We all have a role to play. And Dr. King's life taught us all that. And I think today, as we celebrate his legacy and celebrate his memory, I think we all have a responsibility to, from time to time, go and take a look at ourselves in the mirror and ask ourselves honestly and nakedly, dear God, am I doing my part? Am I doing my part? You know, Dr. King, the work that Dr. King started is long from being over. Yes, there are still many injustices in America, in the world. He reminded us that if there's a justice and an injustice in the state of Oklahoma, that affects you in Georgia. If there is an injustice in California, that affects us in Oklahoma. If there is an injustice in Indiana, it affects those in Texas. He said an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Everywhere. Dear God, am I doing my part? I remember back in 1968, I grew up in a home with my mother and father and our siblings, my siblings. I grew up in a home that I had a World War II father. And there was one thing that that World War II generation, they all had in common. They thought that men should never cry. Men should not show emotion. And if you had a father in that World War II generation, I doubt very seriously you ever saw them shed tears unless it was at the funeral of their spouse or of a child. That generation didn't believe in showing emotion. They thought it made you weak to show emotion. And I'll never forget the day, about 10 years of age, 1968, the day I saw my father cry. Interesting thing, fascinating, baffling to me, to see J.C. Buddy Watts cry. And he put his hands over his face and he scurried out of the room so his wife and kids would not see him cry. I'll never forget the day that it was announced, 120 South G Street, Eufaul, Oklahoma, that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated. It impacted me tremendously. While my father was crying. Never seen it. My father was a pastor. I never saw him cry in the pulpit. I never saw him getting emotional and shedding tears in the pulpit. But that day, the day I saw Buddy White's cry, had a tremendous impact on my life. I wanted to know more about Dr. King, and I have probably read everything that's been written by or about Martin Luther King Jr. I wanted to know his life. I wanted to know what this nonviolent thing was about. And friends, let me tell you something. As Sister Clayton said, all that Dr. King went through, the strikes and the stabbings and the spitting and the kicking and the ugliness, how could you remain nonviolent? How could you do it? You know, God always has a way of knowing who to make the drum major, who to put out front. I don't think anybody could have been first to tear down the color walls, color barriers of Major League Baseball. God knew exactly what he was doing in putting Jackie Robinson there. God couldn't have chosen just any man, any black man to be the leader of the movement. He knew exactly what he was doing when he called this minister named Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. One of the first things I wanted to do when I was elected to Congress, two members of Congress I wanted to talk to. I wanted to talk to Lou Stokes because Lou was the chairman of the King Commission that investigated the assassination, and I wanted to sit down with Lou and just pick his brain and say, Lou, tell me about this. I've always been curious about this. What did your investigation tell? What did you see from the investigation? And I also wanted to sit down with John Lewis. Because I wanted to talk to somebody that was right there on the front line, shoulder to shoulder with him, and I wanted to ask the question. I wanted to ask John the question, John, how did you remain nonviolent? I said, I've been waiting for years to ask somebody that question. John said it was not only taught, it was lived by Dr. King. It was lived. You see, Dr. King took it literally when Christ said, turn the other cheek. Forgive your brother 7 times 7. And I got to tell you, there's been times in my life, there's been times in my ministry that I wanted to grab somebody in their collar and shake them and hoping that it wouldn't affect my testimony. But the Lord would speak to my heart and say, see them as they can be, not as they are. God knew exactly what he was doing in taking this minister from Georgia and giving him to the world to teach us about character, teach us about compassion, to teach us about conviction, to teach us about equality and justice. And I know, unfortunately, sometimes we think that Dr. King's work was just to teach some and not all. You see, Dr. King wanted to teach me as an African-American male. He wanted to teach Sonny Perdue as a Caucasian male. He wanted to teach Native Americans and Asians and Indians, and he wanted to teach all people. He was a gift to us all. Not just to Georgia, thank God, but to every other state in our beloved Union. You know, from time to time over the last 29 years, my wife and I have 5 kids, ranging from 14 to 29, 3 grandkids, 3 daughters, 2 sons. Of those 3 daughters, during Christmas time, I've had the experience of having to put together governor dollhouses. And I am so thankful that I don't have to do that anymore. Because at 4:30 in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, you're trying to read the instructions, and you've got the glue stuck on your fingers, and it's got your fingers stuck together, and you're frustrated, and you just want to just go and just junk it all and say, let's go get them another gift. And then it's 5 o'clock, and then it's 5:30, and you know that about 6:30, 6:45, they're going to be coming down the stairs, and here you are with this thing about 75% finished or completed, and it's so frustrating. And when I talk to all the parents that's gone through that experience, has had that experience, I ask them, what's the most important thing that was in that box and trying to help you put that dollhouse together? If I was to ask some of you in here tonight or this morning that's had that experience, some of you would say the directions. Some of you would say the glue. I say you're both wrong. The most important thing in that box was the picture on the box that showed what it was supposed to look like. And friends, that's the gift that Dr. King left for us. He gave us a picture of what it's supposed to look like. He gave us a picture of what courage, what conviction, what compassion, what family, what faith, what freedom and equality is supposed to look like. How can my son know how to be a man if he does not see his dad being a man? How can my son know how to be a father if he doesn't see his dad being a father? Dr. King would say to us all this morning, give America a picture of what it's supposed to look like. Let's give our families a picture, men, of what it's supposed to look like. Let's give our families a picture, moms, of what it's supposed to look like. Let's give our communities, elected officials, a picture of what it's supposed to look like. You see, I don't think that God ever meant for us to look like Republicans or to look like Democrats or to look like independents. He wanted us to look like servants. He that is greatest amongst you, let them serve. Let you be his servant. As I close, I want to leave you with this. I heard a story once that I think is so fitting, and friends, not here, not just here in Georgia, but in Oklahoma or every other state in the nation. Politics these days seems to be so poisoned and so vitriolic. You know, I have had the privilege of getting to know some people in the last 15 years that it's been an interesting experience. And ironically, several of them here in Atlanta, Georgia. And Andy Young is an interesting guy, as I've gotten to know him and to observe his life. And I've often prayed, God, give me Andy Young's composure. Andy doesn't get stressed out about anything. Just never see him being stressed about anything. Lord, give me Andy Young's stress level, his tolerance for stress. You know, and Andy and I have had this conversation before, and I've had this conversation with red, yellow, brown, black, and white people. And then I've asked them, why does it have to be us versus them? Why does it have to be me versus you? Why does it have to be I or me? Why can't it be we or us? I'm always a little apprehensive about people that use the pronouns when you first meet them, those pronouns I and me. Always makes me a little apprehensive. True story I heard once about a family, rural family in rural Kansas, a mother and a father and a four-year-old son by the name of Johnny. And one day a traveling photographer came by and he knocked on this mother's door and at 10 o'clock in the morning, and the mother was washing dishes and she was walking to the door drying her hands on her apron, and she answered the door, and there was this traveling photographer standing there, and he said, ma'am, he said, I'm a traveling photographer. He said, for a small fee, I'd be more than delighted to set my equipment up and take a picture of farm animals or farm equipment. Maybe you've got some kids, but for a small fee, I'll do that. This mother thought this was the greatest thing since mustard greens and candied yams, that this traveling photographer had come around to her farm. She said, sir, this is great. She said, my husband takes the pickup to work every day. I don't get to town very often. And she said, I've got a four-year-old named Johnny, and I love to put him in his Sunday best and have you take his picture. Came in, sat his equipment up, put little Johnny in his Sunday best, sat him there in front of the camera, and put his little teddy bear in his arms. The photographer took several different snaps and several different shots, and he gathered his equipment, explained to the mother the payment procedure, and headed out the door. Little Johnny was still in his Sunday best, and he said, Mom, can I go outside and play? And she said, yes, Johnny, you can go outside and play for about 45 minutes. And Johnny was so excited to get outside. The last thing she said to Johnny was, don't slam the screen door. But it was too late, man. Johnny hit that screen door and headed outside to play. In the 45 minutes, the mother went to the edge of the porch, and she called her little Johnny's name several times at the top of her voice. Little Johnny never responded to the call, and she walked on out to the farmyard, and she looked under the farm equipment, she looked in the hay barn, she looked in the hayloft, but to no avail, she never found a little Johnny. And this mother, she went all over that farmyard looking for little Johnny, and she never found him. At about 3 hours had passed, and this mother had started to panic, and by this time, the father had come home from work, the chief of police, the fire department had come out, friends and neighbors from the rural and urban area had come out to join in the search for little Johnny. And they searched and they searched and they searched, but they never found him. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and it had gotten so cold and so dark, they had to discontinue the search. But they decided 4 hours later at 6 o'clock in the morning that all come back and they would continue the search. 6 o'clock in the morning, approximately 300 people, Bill, joined in and came back, and then they continued the search, and they searched and they searched, and after about 3 hours, a lady came up with an idea. She said, I've got an idea. Why don't we join hands and walk down the field side by side, and whoever finds little Johnny, send up a yell. And everybody thought it was a great idea, and so then they joined hands and they walked down the field side by side holding hands, and after a couple of hours a yell came up, he's here! And man, everyone ran over to see little Johnny, and this mother was on the other side of the pasture, and you can imagine the anxiety in this mother's heart as only a mother can have. She fought through the farm equipment, and she fought through the farmyard, and she fought through all the people trying to make it to her little Johnny. She was going to finally get to see her little four-year-old. And finally she made it to her little Johnny. And she discovered that her little Johnny was dead. And this mother reached down and she cuddled her little Johnny, and she was crying, and big old tears were coming down her cheeks, and this mother was crying and rocking with her little Johnny. And after a minute or so, she looked up at her husband, she looked up at the mayor, she looked up at the chief of police, and she said, If we would have only joined hands sooner, my Johnny would be alive. Friends, I have to believe that Dr. King would speak to our hearts today and say, in spite of our differences, in spite of our skin color, in spite of our geography, in spite of the things that we might disagree on, if you join hands and do it together, our kids, our families, our communities will live. Thank you very much.